Kansas City is home to an international folk conference. It's kind of a big deal. As the city prepares to welcome folk musicians from all over the world, the time is right for a conversation about the very essence and meaning of folk music. I'm Gina Kaufman. On today's show, we'll sit down with local music scholars. We'll talk about music performed in prisons and at giant festivals in the American rural South and in cities of Portugal, all in an effort to define folk music in 2015. Can we do it? That's coming up on Central Standard after this news. Last year, some 3,000 musicians from around the world descended on downtown, jamming all day and performing all night. It was the first conference held by Folk Alliance International since the organization relocated to Kansas City, and by all accounts, it was awesome. A lot of people who attended that first year were surprised by the range of styles and performers the Folk Alliance brought to town. Some local musicians discovered at the conference that they were folk musicians. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on Central Standard, as the second Folk Alliance International Conference heads to Kansas City, we're going to ask, what is folk music today, and who exactly are the folks? Beau Bledsoe, guitarist and master of culturally specific stringed instruments from around the world, welcome to Central Standard.
My pleasure, Gina.
Correct me if I'm mistaken, but I suspect you might be just the kind of guy I was describing before. Prior to the Folk Alliance establishing its headquarters in Kansas City, would you have labeled yourself a folk musician?
Well, you know, the word folk has many different meanings.
I noticed you used the L.
Yeah. I was thinking that it was going to be kind of the folk we know from the 60s and the 70s, the kind of a blowing in the wind kind of a thing. But I do consider myself an avid folklorist in playing folkloric music from other cultures.
Let's talk about what you do, because when we met, you were a tango musician primarily with a lot of interest in the study and mastery of flamenco guitar as well. And then as far as my memory goes, you met a Turkish woman who would become your wife, and you got really into this traditional Turkish guitar called an oud. And then there was the Portuguese fado, and now you're exploring Roma or gypsy music. So what would you say it is you do?
I call myself, I'm a classical chamber musician. You know, I was educated in universities and as a classical musician with a really deep interest in cultural anthropology. And I love to go to different places, live there for a while, study the music, and come back and impose that onto all my friends.
How would you define folk music?
Briefly, I would say anything that is outside of that conservatory academic tradition, what we call classical music. But ultimately, these are all kind of delusions that human beings set up for themselves. I think so. These delineations, but we need those.
Why do we need them?
Well, because we need to label things and to describe things. And
have conferences?
Yes, fun conferences about them. Yes.
I'd like to introduce as well Daniel Atkinson to this conversation. He's the assistant director of the Kansas African Studies Center at KU. He's also an ethnomusicologist who has recorded music performed by prisoners inside the storied Angola prison down south. Hi, Daniel.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. You?
Great. What is your definition of folk music?
My definition of folk music is basically anything that is performed by a group of people in a communal setting where it sort of defines, expands, or creates meaning in a way that verifies them for who they are and something that they can do going forward with their community as well, something that they can pass from hand to hand, mouth to mouth, mouth to ear sort of a thing. in order to sort of make sense of the world in which they live in. One thing that music does beautifully for a lot of people throughout the world is help them to recognize the situations that they are in, good or bad, in order to liberate themselves. And if you can do that as a community, that's a fantastic way to do that and to basically shore up meaning in life. And that's what I think folk music is. And that's the definition that I've sort of worked with over time.
So tell me more about your personal experience with folk music.
Well, I used to work for a rather large folk festival in Seattle called Northwest Folk Life during the end of May every year. And something like 25 stages, some of them go 11 hours a day. Each set is half an hour. There are changeovers of 10 minutes. A quarter of a million people will come in the sunnier years, and we'll have 8,500 or so performers. So it's just crazy all day long, every day. Everything from Contra to pirate metal to 8-bit music to subversive square dancers, which are people who sort of throw away the gender-specific identities in square dancing, and then they identify male by holding a handkerchief in their hand and do their dancing to Madonna records and things of that nature.
Did this question of what qualifies as folk music ever come up in that setting?
Oh, yes, clearly, and in a much more tangible way before I even got there. A good friend of mine named Devin Leger was really pushing the boundaries when I first got there by bringing in 8-bit and things of that nature. But in the early 1980s, there were people who were challenging that because there were black gospel choirs who weren't allowed to perform at the festival because it wasn't fiddles and banjos. And most of the people who were in that string tradition, the Scots-Irish style, didn't even know that the banjo has African origins. And so the woman, Pastor Pat, was very subversive in how she got her point across, in that she just showed up and made a spectacle. And because what she did was so entertaining and so compelling that people stopped what they were doing to come see her. And she was on the edge of the Seattle Center campus, so they had to let her in because what she was doing was more entertaining and enlightening than what was being highlighted on the stages. So she sort of forced the issue. The same thing happened with the Hawaiian community and a few others. And it was difficult for me to bring some of these communities back in because they felt slighted, and that was still living memory for a lot of them.
We've had you on the show before to talk about the music you've recorded inside Angola Prison. Those recordings have also inspired a jazz project. Is the music you heard in Angola Prison, would you call that folk music?
Yes, very much so. That a cappella gospel and the recording that we also made with Howard Wiley and the dynamic Miss Faye Carroll, very much. We tried to encompass the totality of Afro-American music from ring shouts and field hollers all the way through hip-hop.
So then, yeah, the adaptation of that music is also folk.
Yes, and we wanted to show that genres do very little to promote sovereignty within the black community and sort of spreads us out. And we wanted to promote the idea of black American music being something that has infinite possibilities but derives from the same well, creative well.
Well, we've got one more voice to bring into this conversation, a familiar voice here on KCUR, Chuck Haddix, host of the Friday and Saturday night Fish Fry and director of the Mars Sound Archive. Hi, Chuck.
Hey, Gina. How are you today?
Pretty good. What about you? How do you define folk music?
I think folk music is acoustic music that tells a story that's passed from generation to generation. You know, these epic events like John Henry, songs of disaster, and love songs too. I think I'm very, very much in the vein with the Folk Alliance in that I cast my net pretty broadly when it comes to folk music. But and it's music that's communal too. You know, you have the Hoolies in the Irish tradition, where you have a big sing-along. Back in the 60s, we had the shindigs and you know the sing-alongs back then, the hoot nannies is what they called them. It's acoustic music and it's Americana. It's all based in Americana.
It's all based in Americana. So you don't think of folk music as being global?
Yeah, I do today, but I'm talking about, I guess, from my perspective, folk music is international and they do share themes, but in terms of American folk music, a lot of it's based upon English ballad traditions and African-American music traditions. It's a kind of blend of that.
You call the Fish Fry a public radio music party, and every week you list the genres you cover, the best in blues, R&B, soul, jumpin' jazz, and Zydeco. Do those count as folk in your mind?
Not all of them. You know, Joe Turner in the Kansas City jazz tradition would be a folk musician because he was a vocalist. And but not all folk, but I do include a portion of folk music as in part of the program, certainly a lot of acoustic blues.
So I want to go through some – I've thought a little bit about what are some of the characteristics that might be defining aspects of folk. And I want your input on whether these are sort of characteristics that we can see as, I don't know, continuous or defining. So let's see what you think about this. It emerges not from a known individual musician, but from a community. It's music that a community owns and shares. Daniel, what do you think about that?
I try to stay away from definitive statements when it comes to something like that, because as soon as you declare something is a certain thing, there's something that comes along that completely bursts your bubble. So it could work, but then it could not work. So that's as much as I would say about that, because most people, I used to have to fight to get hip hop into the folk festival that I worked at. And people just didn't understand that it could be, which means that they didn't really understand the value system or the place that it held in the community in which it lived there in the Central District in Seattle. And then once we brought it in, we saw how everyone came out and they all knew the music and they all derived meaning from it, sort of like how most people would not consider Mays featuring Frankie Beverly folk music. But I do, because they can fill arenas with thousands of people. And Frankie Beverly can't even sing anymore. And he'll start the song and then he just drops it off and puts the mic out to the audience. And then they all hold hands and they sing and they sort of establish a sense of beauty together. And they all absolutely love it and enjoy it. And it's terribly uplifting for all of these people, for thousands of people.
Do you think uplift is part of it?
I think it is, in a matter that, like I was saying before, where you state what is bothering you, particularly in the black tradition, and that's how you obtain liberation when you can't deal with the thing that is oppressing you institutionally. By recognizing it with people who share the experience with, you can uplift and shed it.
Bo, what do you think? Do you have this sense that it's music that belongs to a group of people and that uplift might have some role to play?
Uplift and also catharsis. You see a lot of healing that happens. Mm-hmm. In flamenco, they have an expression called quijo, the ability of the performer to really complain and impart that feeling to the listener. And, you know, the audience and the performer are often considered kind of one and the same.
I think it's communal in the sense that it's a shared tradition. For example, Robert Johnson, the king of the Delta blues singers, comes along late in the tradition. And he borrows a lot what came before, and he polished it and made it into a more lyrical expression of the blues. And I think it does uplift you. Joe Turner said it best when he said, the blues will make you happy too. By articulating the blues, it makes you feel better.
Well, this issue then of the communal nature being ownership and recognition rather than the creative process necessarily, I think is really helpful, because one of the dangers I think there is, especially when you're looking at a group that you don't belong to and their artistic creations of any kind, is this idea that it just emerges magically from, quote unquote, the people. And that can in some ways romanticize or dismiss that there was a creative act that took place and some skill and at some point, originality. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that, let me think about that for a minute. I think that, if you go back and you look at the song Goodnight Irene, it was recorded by Lead Belly in 1934 for the Library of Congress. He began performing it about 1908. He learned it from two uncles, and it's based upon an earlier theme from 1886 that was based on an earlier theme that was lost in the tradition.
Let's listen to that song, actually, because we have it here. Anything else you want to say about Lead Belly and Goodnight Irene before we listen to this? Because I'll admit something, Chuck, I was surprised. I feel like In the Pines is kind of like, if you want something that has been covered and many versions of it, that would have been the obvious selection.
You know, Well, Goodnight Irene, of course, was in 34, and then a year after Lead Belly died in 1950, the Weavers recorded it, and they had a number one hit on the pop charts with it. But they had to sanitize the lyrics because he talks about he's going to jump in the river and drown and take morphine and die. Also, it's a song about a woman other than his wife.
All right, quite scandalous. Let's give a listen to Lead Belly's Goodnight Irene.
Irene, good night. Irene, good night. Good night, Irene, and good night, Irene. I guess you in my dream. Sometimes I'll live.
So, Chuck, what is quintessentially folk about this? And about maybe Lead Belly himself.
Well, Lead Belly really inspired Woody Guthrie, Bob Dylan, Janis Joplin, and a whole generation of folk musicians during the 1960s. You know, he's one of the first really big blues stars after the crash of the stock market, because John and Alan Lomax, who were folk catchers, they were song catchers, were documenting folk culture for the Library of Congress, and they recorded him in prison. And that's where A Good Night Irene was recorded, and it was released by Library of Congress in 1934. So he really inspired that whole generation of folk music, and his songs become Midnight Special, become standard repertoire. He was a great songwriter.
So is that part of it, that these are songs that take on new life in many different hands with many different voices?
Yes, and he's also a prime example of why, of how you can tie something like this to an individual, where he was unique in that he plays the 12-string guitar, which is something that was much more common with Mexican folks in East Texas. So it was a little bit rare, but because Shreveport was such a town where things would come and go, especially on Fannin Street, there was always something happening. There was a beautiful means for exchange. And he also was a little divergent in his songwriting, where he was clever enough to sort of, he could do just about anything. He was a really clever guy. And much like say Biggie and Tupac were for the generation a generation ago, those itinerant black musicians were very much in the same vein. They were a marked difference from what had come before, because they could choose who they did or did not have sex with, how they made their living, and they could travel freely. So he was a unique individual in that regard, as were the others who had that talent and the wherewithal to just go out into the world with a guitar on their back. And an absolutely fantastic individual and a wellspring of knowledge and an innovator in many, many ways.
He was also a multi-instrumentalist. He played zydeco on the accordion. Played mandolin. He could play any instruments. That gave his music a much richer texture.
You know, I'm still kind of hung up a little bit on this idea of music just emerging from a community versus individuals and the role that they may play in it. But how does that play out in the kinds of music, the kinds of folkloric music that you study and perform?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, you always have someone that kind of pokes out of the texture that's, standing on a mountain of tradition. And usually they're the ones that push the art forward and keep it from becoming a dead art form or a museum piece. And those are the people like Lead Belly that we look up to, that usually, you know, or a Charlie Parker or something like that, that completely change the vocabulary and move it forward.
What would you say about the role of, like, polish or virtuosity in folk traditions?
Well, it's like any other genre of music. I mean, you can reach a really high level of technique, and being a rough musician doesn't make you immediately a folkloric musician. You know,
it's not a qualification.
Yeah. Some people think it is, but yeah, it's not true.
Daniel, what do you think about that?
So there's... The way I look at it is there's room for all. Like, say, you could be a guitarist like Bo Diddley, who was not very technically gifted, but what he had was the clave, And he could play that same rhythm all night. And no matter what, you're going to keep coming back. You're going to keep dancing. And that's the point. Or you could be someone like Jimi Hendrix, who has beautiful, virtuosic curiosity in the way that he expressed something as simple as the blues. And when he married that with technology, he created a whole new thing. Or you could be someone like...
So Jimi Hendrix is a folk musician too?
I think that he springs from a folk tradition and did something a little different with it. I mean, he could play some beautiful acoustic blues, and who knows, maybe it has evolved into folk music, but at the time he was doing something brand new that a lot of people really had problems with. I mean, when he played the national anthem, he caused a huge uproar when he brought in the Rockets' Red Glare and the bombs.
Yeah, well, this tension, I feel like there's a tension between tradition and transformation, or tradition and invention. And maybe the idea of folk music is that it's something that walks that very blurry line, you know, where those things kind of meet.
Well, there's always been, I think what you're looking for here is a traditionalist. There's always going to be the traditionalist that will say, you have to play it this way. You can't change. You know, when Bob Dylan plugged in with Paul Butterfield Blues Band at the Newport Folk Festival,
went electric.
It caused quite a controversy because they were introducing electricity into what was an acoustic tradition. As far as virtuosity, though, I think there's a lot of different expressions of folk music, and some of it's more lyrical than others. Like, for example, if you listen to Mississippi John Hurt, the themes are blues, but he's very much a virtuoso. Wonderful 12-string guitarist also.
Especially with form. Like, what he does with form is outrageous. Like, 35-bar blues, and it works. He finds a way to make it happen.
Central Standard is going to take a short break. When we get back, we'll hear some wildly divergent examples of folk music as interpreted by our guests, and we'll ask who folk music traditions belong to anyway. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we are talking about folk music with the Folk Alliance International Conference happening here in town for the second year in a row. The big question today, what is folk in 2015? Good morning again, Chuck Haddix.
Well, good morning, Gina. It's awfully nice to be here with you.
Nice to have you. And hello to you, Bo Bledsoe.
Hello, Gina.
Welcome back, Daniel Atkinson.
How you doing?
Great. So let's talk about the stereotypical American folk music concept. Pete Seeger, Malvina Reynolds, Woody Guthrie, those kinds of people. Chuck?
Well, you know, they draw from earlier traditions, as we mentioned earlier, and they were the ones that really popularized folk music. Folk music's always been there. The Carter family's folk music, Zydeco's folk music. And it's always been there. But Martin Mull refers it to the 1960s as the great folk scare, when that stuff almost caught on. And during the early 1960s, you know, the folk music was played on top 40 radio. Peter, Paul, and Mary was folk music. Bob Dylan went a long way to popular, and still does, to popularizing folk music.
Let's hear a little of what might spring to a lot of people's minds when you just say the phrase folk music. This is Pete Seeger's Oh, Susanna.
I come from Alabama with my banjo on my knee. I'm going to Louisiana, my true love for to see. It rained all night the day I left, the weather it was dry. The sun so hot I froze to death, Susanna, don't you cry. Oh, Susanna, don't you cry for me. I come from Alabama with my banjo on my knee.
So, this is about as pure a folk music in most people's minds as it can get, or do you disagree with that this is sort of the stereotypical idea of folk music? Daniel?
See, this is the thing. You sort of start treading in some odd water here, where the idea of something is more important than the reality.
Right.
Where this is a Stephen Foster song, which was a pop song 100 years earlier.
I had no idea.
And so it just depends on how it's presented, and guys like Pete Seeger would popularize tunes out of context, but people saw that and he took it for what it was, and then the definition was fixed, and that became a problem when people wanted to actually be themselves, and then they become forced. You have to be this thing, whatever it is that we define it is as, and you as a person are not allowed to do that. Case in point, when people started electrifying at the Newport Festival, and then the power gets unplugged because they want them to be something that they typically obviously don't want to be. They're trying to push boundaries rather than exist within them.
Right. The questions about authenticity, which is kind of what the question was then when you're unplugging, when you're turning the electricity off to try and make someone do what you think is quote unquote authentic. But if, you know, if using electricity is what comes authentically and naturally to Bob Dylan, then where do we define authenticity? Bo, what do you think about this stuff?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, I'm a living, performing musician. So, like I said earlier, I think a lot of these delineations are just human things that we make up.
Human arbitrariness.
Yeah, that, you know, that, but they're very necessary.
Well, the music has to evolve. If you look at the music of the Creoles and the Cajuns in southwest Louisiana, those are very isolated communities, and the music, very distinctive music developed there. And before World War II, basically the Creoles, who are African-Americans, mixed race folk, and the Cajuns, who came from Canada and spoke French, they both spoke French, they played the same kind of music on the, with the same instrumentation. When they get out into the world during World War II, the Creoles get exposed to American R&B, which gives you Clifton Chenier, and the Cajuns gravitate towards country music, which gives you Dewey Balfa, and, so, and also the string bands that came out of Texas, Milton Brown and his Musical Brownies. They begin to adapt that and that style, and the music splits into two different directions. And it's still Zydeco or Cajun music, but it just changed at that point.
I want to talk about the role of revolt or social cause as part of folk music, or what a lot of people think of as part of folk music. Let's listen to Little Boxes by Malvina Reynolds, and then we'll talk about that.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university, where they were put in boxes, and they came out all the same. And there's doctors and
so and she's clearly got some social commentary going on here, and this is a song that's taken on all kinds of new life and all kinds of different covers. But do you think that revolt and protest are part of folk music?
I think it's part of music in general. It's making a statement. If you look at, for example, Billie Holiday's song Strange Fruit, it makes a very powerful statement about lynching. And it does it in not a direct way. If you look at Black, Brown, and Beige by Big Bill Brunzi, that also has a message. Langston Hughes refers to that in its poetry. And if you look at the time of popularity of American folk music in the 60s, it was a very volatile time. You had the Civil Rights Movement. You had Vietnam. And so folk music became a vehicle for protest. Think of Bob Dylan's Masters of War, of making a statement. Also, folk music by its nature, I think this, a lot of this comes out of Woody Guthrie, too, champions the individual over the mass. That you can't put them in little boxes.
Yes, I mean, usually if you're going to make an expression in the folk idiom, there's something that's compelling you to do that, and whatever is compelling you to do that is going to come out of your music, be it love or be it anger or strife or anger or whatever it's going to be, and it could be all of those things, and it could be none of those things. So it's based on whatever, however you feel like you need to derive or transmit meaning. And then it could be an element of protest, but it could be any number of things. And when we sort of categorize people and put them into little boxes, just like in the piece here, I think that's the problem. But in those boxes are where a lot of people derive comfort, and that's an issue.
Well, a really interesting discovery I made last year, which would be kind of the opposite of, you know, usually folk music does take on the role of social protest. Everyone over 50 in Lisbon just can't even listen to Portuguese fado, which is their folk music, because of its association with the Salazar regime. And, you know, it was a folk music kind of wedded to a fascist government and is really being only saved by very young people that don't have that memory.
That's interesting. And it's a form of music that was translated in a colonial and post-colonial context in Brazil. Is that right?
Well, yeah, most certainly.
And then you and some other people here started performing it, and it became like this question of who does this music belong to, and can we, these Midwestern kids, well, maybe not kids, but can we master this form? Can we learn it? Can we be fadistos, fadistas?
Well, I mean, all we could do was just try and really learn the conservative tradition, all the little forms, and we would just go to the elders and ask for lessons, and you know, in the time we had. But I was really struck with the political implications it all had.
We're going to be able to listen to a little bit of fado music soon. Can you tell us more about what we need to know to understand what we're going to hear?
Well, fado roughly translates into fate. And it's one of the only folkloric traditions that comes out of an urban style, like Argentine tango would be another one.
Urban, you know, folks.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, usually it's the reverse. It goes from rural areas into the cities. But, you know, it's songs of nostalgia and seafaring people and love and loss, same stuff.
Okay, yeah. So nostalgia and seafaring. Let's hear Fado Novado, one of Bo Bledsoe's projects.
Tempos batistas, tempos mortos que eu vivi. Velhos amigos, velhos pecados. Velhas batistas, pelos mais.
But what I admire about the way you perform not only this music but all sorts of other music from various folkloric traditions is, I mean, aside from musical considerations and admiration, is that you are so transparent about who you are and how you relate to the music you're playing. A lot of people who are inspired by global traditions fall into this pitfall of sometimes, I don't know, assuming superficial affectation related to the community they're exploring, or even attempt to take on an identity that's not their own. And you're always you. Are there kind of guidelines that you've set up for yourself, or does that come naturally as a side effect of genuine respect?
Well, you know, there is some pretending that has to happen when you go there, and you do pick up affectations that may be very small, but I'm not going to change my name or dye my hair or anything.
I've heard you respond to questions about culture and things like that by saying, "I don't know, I'm from Arkansas." Just being
that's always my defense.
Well, I want to get back to this whole idea of protest. Fado is an example of something that's kind of like because of its political connotations, difficult for people today. Chuck, one of the songs you've brought is John Henry, performed by Josh White. What should we know about Josh White and perhaps even the story of John Henry?
Well, Josh White is a bluesman, but he was a very lyrical bluesman, and he was very popular. He was a bluesman that crossed over into the folk field. His themes are not necessarily, I shot my baby in some of the rougher blues. He's a very polished bluesman. And he had a big hit with a revival of a song about a steel-driving man. This is an industrial ballad really out of the English tradition, Man Against the Machine, where John Henry is driving through the mountain, and he's competing with a machine that's driving through the mountain, and he triumphs, but he dies with his hammer in his hand.
Is this one of – I mean, I would say this is an iconic story – of American folk music.
Yes, it is. It's one of the foundations. It's actually based upon an earlier theme.
Well, let's listen to John Henry by Josh White.
Henry said to his shaker, "Well now, shaker, why don't you sing? 'Cause I'm throwing 9 pounds from my hips on down. Just listen to the cold steel ring. Boy, just listen to the cold steel ring." John Henry said to his shaker, "Well now, shaker, why don't you pray? 'Cause if my hammer miss that little piece of steel, tomorrow be your barren day. Well, tomorrow..."
So what are we hearing here? What do we need to understand about folk music when we hear this selection, Chuck?
Well, I think there's a lot of different styles of folk music and a lot of different genres. For example, there's the work songs. A lot of what Alan Lomax and John Lomax recorded were with prisoners in Louisiana and Texas were songs that they sang when they worked. And so this is what that is. And it's the eternal theme, man against machine, and how he ultimately triumphed in the end, although he died.
It was triumph in spite of death.
It was based upon a true incident in West Virginia when they were burrowing a tunnel through the side of a mountain. That's really hard work because you're going through rock, and there's John Henry competing with the hammer with the machine.
Would you say that there's pre-industrial nostalgia in this, or do you think that it's sort of a timeless battle that it just translates differently in different time periods?
Well, I think it's a timeless battle. I mean, the mechanization of the cotton fields down south led to the Great Migration because jobs dried up. The Luddites had a real point in their own kind of way about machines and how they put people out of work. We're seeing that today. Computers, the same thing.
Daniel, what about man versus machine?
Well, there's all kinds of romantic notions with regard to the Industrial Revolution and the mechanization of the of production in the United States. But one thing about John Henry that is important is that it's a story about a black man who beats a white invention. With all he has is his two hands and a hammer, something that's been used for thousands of years. And it's an affirming story. And something that there weren't a whole lot of examples of, and it became very popular, which was a point of pride for a lot of people. But then it also seeds certain ideas of stereotypes about black strength and brutishness, and then it sort of makes people start to think about the importance of stereotypes in our culture, in that it's not that stereotypes are untrue, it's just that they're incomplete, right?
Central Standard's got to take one more quick break. When we return, more music and more talk. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard. Stay tuned. This hour is slipping away. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with musician Beau Bledsoe, ethnomusicologist Daniel Atkinson, and KCUR's own Chuck Haddix about what is folk music and who are folks. Daniel, we were just talking with you about some of the specific issues having to do with race and American folk music. We haven't yet talked about religion and American folk music and maybe some of its intersection with race. You brought in some examples of African American folk music that sound a lot different from some of what we've already heard so far. Can you talk to us a little bit about the group, the Dixie Hummingbirds?
So the Dixie Hummingbirds are a Tidewater-style gospel quartet, usually 4 to maybe even 8 members. They all have very specific roles with a clear leader, someone who's in the bass, someone who's in the top, and then people who create and release tension in the middle. That process is fascinating to me. And it's something that you don't hear very much, but I did capture it at Angola State Penitentiary in Louisiana and in Washington, D.C. when I was there working for the Smithsonian as well in various forms. They were those types of groups are quite important because they are indicative of the American experience of Afro-Americans here, where it has all the trappings of the situation that Afro-Americans face, particularly with how they pick up the 12-tone system, things like four-part harmony, and how that was used in the minstrel tradition, which you see in the minstrel shows from that time period, or even, say, what you see in the historically black universities, what they were doing originally when they were sort of selling the idea of black sovereignty and black education and doing it in ways that were very much, you were trying to find an acceptable version of these four-part harmonies in ways that were very detrimental because it excluded black sovereignty. But the stuff that you hear in the churches from, say, the 1930s through the 1960s, up until just after the death of Sam Cooke, where people are coming to the church to sort of have that collective experience where they know that they're less than a human 6 days out of the week, but that one day they can all get together and express this sort of a thing. And they did it on plantations in secret, but this is an environment where they could really, really do it, and then they could sort of elevate people who had more skill than others to be in front, like Ruth Brown was one of them, Sam Cooke was one. But the Dixie Hummingbirds, led by Mr. Ira Tucker, were absolutely phenomenal and specialists. Also, the Swan Silvertones, among my favorite. But which piece are we going to hear?
We're
going to
hear Ezekiel Saw the Wheel.
Okay.
Let's give that a listen. Ezekiel Saw the Wheel by the Dixie Hummingbirds.
Ezekiel saw the wheel.
He saw that wheel.
Where in the middle of the air? Ezekiel saw the wheel.
He saw that wheel.
In the middle of the air.
This same
Ezekiel saw the wheel.
He saw that wheel.
Where in the middle of the air? Ezekiel saw the wheel. In the middle of the air.
One of these mornings about 5 o'clock,
don't you know,
in the middle of the air,
don't go well as it's so well, look on real in the rock, you know,
in the middle of the air,
listen,
Ezekiel saw the wheel,
he saw that wheel,
where in the middle of the air.
So there's, it's kind of like a combination of a religious song, and there's an aspect of work song to it, but there's also, I don't know. I'm wondering what kinds of continuity. It's easy to hear the differences between this and what we've heard before. What kind of continuity do you hear?
Well, again, with the idea of deriving meaning, especially where they can tell a Bible story in a couple of minutes. So whether you can read or write, it doesn't matter. And that's how originally these exchanges were taking place as a result of an evangelical minister by the name of Isaac Watt in the 19th century, who was making it so Scots-Irish farmers and the descendants of slaves could exchange ideas freely because they had in common, they were poor, and they could not read or write. So the tunes that the hymns that he expressed to them used simple duple meters, one- and two-syllable words, things that could be easily remembered and repeated and sort of reverberated over time from holler to holler, village to village, town to town. And
so how things are passed and questions surrounding, like, formal education and literacy sounds like part of the history here.
Well, yes, and this particular tune as well, there's a great example of this where Dan Rather a few years ago was interviewing the Blind Boys of Alabama, and he said, you know, because he grew up in Texas, so he says, there's one tune that you do that I absolutely love, and he starts singing Ezekiel Saw the Wheel, and then they all do it together, and even though they were not raised together, they all know this because they have a shared culture, a shared sort of matrix that goes back even farther than their parents or grandparents.
Well, it's the foundation of American music is the call and the response, whether it's a jazz soloist and then the band responding, or the preacher, making a statement and then that being echoed by the congregation or out in the fields. That's the foundation of American music, and you can hear it in this music. Ironically, the Fisk Jubilee Singers, which was one of the first really superstars, they actually recorded for the Victor label, when they first went out, they were successful at raising funds for the institution. They toured all over the world. They were big stars in their days. The Golden Gate Quartet in the late 30s had their own radio program on the CBS network. What's interesting, too, it's an a cappella tradition that we're dealing with here. And then Thomas A. Dorsey, who was known as Georgia Tom, who was a low-down bluesman, piano player, became the father of gospel music when he introduced instrumentation into praise music. And it changed everything.
Well, I want to get back to this question about what is folk, because that's my obsession of the day here. Thank you for indulging it. I want to know, I mean, it sounds like Beau's argument all along has been that maybe the answer to this question is no. Is it even really a genre? I mean, it sounds different in different countries. It can be old or new. It's anything made by people during any time period and anywhere around the globe. That's a genre?
I I tend to stay away from genres, yeah. particularly because if you look at, say, something like the Insane Clown Posse, where they have a community of thousands and thousands of people, the Juggalos, and they all get together, and then they are a family. And as crazy and as ridiculous as that may seem to some people, it really means something to them. And what's more special to me about it is that what they're doing, the kind of people who would turn their nose up at it, aren't going to come and take it, because those are the kind of people, if they like what you're doing, they come take what they want and they leave the rest. What they're doing is repulsive in many ways to certain people, so they're left alone to do what they do and derive meaning and value. And it's a beautiful thing. Whether I agree with it or not, I still think it's a beautiful thing.
Chuck?
Well, you know, I'm going to take it in a little bit different direction. You know, we've been talking a lot about historic music that from our context from today. And, you know, you have to realize the music that came up at this time in America was a very different place. And as far as the international aspect of folk music, before Dave Dexter Jr. went to work for Capitol Records as the international A&R man, there's not that many world music recordings being distributed in this country. He was the one that went out and recorded folk music all over the world and issued it on the Capitol International series. He also acquired the Beatles for Capitol Records.
Let's talk about this international thing a little bit more. Bo, we're going to play a clip that you recommended today, Flamenco Vivo by Camarón de la Isla. Did I say that right
Perfect.
At all? Okay.
Yeah.
Let's hear a little bit of flamenco music and talk about whether we can find some kind of through line.
Eso que tú haces no se hace, eso que tú haces no está bien.
Bo, as someone who has worked in folk music's plural, are there interesting through lines connecting different styles of folk music? I mean, musically, like performed all over the world. Are there things that a musician, a trained ear, would pick up on that connect these things more than I might think they're connected?
Well, they're usually, you know, standing on a whole lot of tradition and form. You know, one of the highest compliments you'll hear about Camarón de la Isla is he was a great aficionado, you know, that he really, you know, they give out this prize called the Golden Key, the Llave de Oro, for the greatest singers, and there's only been about three or four of them that have won this prize. And it's really because they somehow managed to learn all the tunes. And, you know, that's a really big deal. But, you know, I forgot the initial question.
Well, I do want to talk about this idea of what folk music is mm-hmm. today before we go. And, Daniel, one of the clips you recommended is by someone current, Ferris and Jason Romero. We have this song, Waiting for the Evening Mail. What does this represent about folk music today?
Well, they very much fit into the accepted definition of what folk is, but they live and breathe the culture. They make their own banjos. They make their own guitars. They cut their own wood. They do the whole thing.
Let's give it a listen.
I went by the jail this morning. Heard a hard luck brother moan. I'm in here, right where I don't belong. Never done no wrong. As I walk by his window, I can hear him singing the song.
Daniel, we've got jail, we've got feeling like an outsider. What do you hear thematically in here that maybe hasn't been discussed before, or that just puts a big exclamation point on something?
They're just singing about life, the things that people go through on a daily basis that other people can identify with and establish meaning and just celebrate life. And They're very nice, fantastic people. I've had the chance to work with them a few times, and every time it's a great thing.
You know, it gives voice to injustice, whether you're in jail or being impressed by the government. It's kind of funny because I'm kind of like a human Pandora. I'm sitting here mixing the fish fry. I'm thinking about this. I'm thinking, well, in the jailhouse now, Jimmie Rodgers, the singing brakeman. You know, it's a common theme. I'm not a big fan of David Allan Coe's, but it's kind of funny. Steve Goodman wrote a song called You Never Even Call Me By My Name. And David Allan Coe said it would be the perfect song, except it doesn't have anything about trucks, mama, or jail. And so he amended. He said, he goes, I was drunk the day that mom got out of prison and went to pick her up in the rain, and she got ran over by a darned old train.
Problem solved. Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. Daniel Atkinson of the Kansas African Studies Center, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Bo Bledsoe of a lot of bands, but right now, especially Ensemble Iberica. It's been great talking to you. Have fun at the conference.
Oh, I will. Yeah, see you there.
Chuck Haddix, as always, it's an honor and a pleasure.
Always good to be here with you, Gina.
This has been a pre-recorded interview for Central Standard. You can enjoy it online at kcur.org/Central Standard later today. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, Suzanne Hogan continues our Folk Alliance coverage. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today. Stick around for Up to Date next.